Welcome to the Scotland Grows Show, the podcast where we celebrate Scottish gardening. I'm MT O'Donnell, editor and producer of Scotland Grows magazine, and your host for this adventure. We are delighted that this series of the Scotland Grows Show is sponsored by Roots, a subscription from National Trust for Scotland, which celebrates Scotland's flora in the form of a Roots pack sent to you every 6 weeks, containing Scottish seeds to grow at home, tips from expert National Trust gardeners, and stories and histories of the Scottish plants protected and cared for by the National Trust, thus helping both your garden and National Trust for Scotland's gardens thrive. Simon Jones is a gardens and designed landscape manager for the National Trust for Scotland, managing gardens such as Threave, Killane, Brockton, Greenbank, Hillhouse, Geeston and Ardooney. Previously, he was curator of plants at the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland, based at Edinburgh Zoo, designing and constructing over 30 exhibits during this time. Outside his role with the National Trust for Scotland, he's a past vice president of the Royal Caledonian Horticultural Society, member of the Incorporation of City Gardeners of Glasgow, past director for Gardening Scotland, and now a committee member with Kinghorn Community Land Association. I'm delighted today to chat to Simon about his work with the National Trust for Scotland, and after hearing his enthusiasm, you too will either want to work for the National Trust for Scotland or go and visit one of their fabulous gardens. Simon, thank you so much for making time to chat with me today on the Scotland Grow Show, as I know you are an extremely busy man.
That's no problem. Happy to be here. Thanks, MT.
So, as we said in the intro, you work for the National Trust for Scotland. It's the largest conservation and heritage charity in Scotland, and it champions more than 76,000 acres of countryside and gardens. I'm scared to ask, but have the NTS gardens, Simon, suffered a lot of damage from the recent storm Babette?
It's more, mainly just focused in the northeast. My poor colleague Chris Wardle has had the lion's share of all the problems in the last few years. So when the storm Arwen hit a couple of years ago, and the other two that quickly followed, it was all the northeast that got battered by that. So their forests were decimated, and I believe maybe not as much devastation because so many trees came down, but they've now got some flooding issues, which has been well reported in the news. And I just spoke to Chris this morning, actually, and him being a gardens manager, he's got his work togs on, he's got his chainsaw out, and he's having to just muck in and get on with it. So, yeah, it's manageable, but it has had some problems. There's no two ways about it. One of the frustrating things is we're emotionally attached to our landscapes, you know, as much as we try not to be, especially as a gardens manager. You've got to be quite removed from being too emotional about it. But we all love trees. They're so emotive. You know, you've seen them grow, you've seen them change shapes, you've seen them get loads of infections and problems wrong with them, structural issues. And all of a sudden, you know, they get split in half by a storm. And it's utterly devastating, actually, because you begin to know them. It sounds a little bit strange, but you begin to know them a little bit personally, if that makes sense, because you've worked on them and worked with them for so long. So I think that's the problems. When I spoke to Chris this morning, he just went, "Oh, mate, you never guess what's happened to this big beech tree." And, you know, and that's what happens. It's you've just got to roll with it, I'm afraid.
And you are in that unenviable position of having to make those really difficult decisions to fell trees, or even, you know, recently with like sudden oak death kind of thing, you've got to make those difficult decisions.
Absolutely. You know, and the thing is, you get a little bit hardened to it in a way. And, you know, you suddenly realise, oh, just chop it down, don't worry about it, you know, it'll be fine, we'll crack on and we'll get going. And you know, and that's just what you've got to say operationally to get the job done. But, you know, in the back of your mind, you're thinking, okay, that's been there since that garden was built. You know, I think you're referencing sudden oak death, which is one of the gardens that I work with, is Ardooney, just south of Oban. And that's had its lion's share of sudden oak death. We've had a lot of trees felled in that location. And that actually took the heart out of that particular garden. And you kind of look at these trees before they come down, and it's quite emotional. Then the trees come down, and then you realise that it's just created this amazing opportunity. And you have to say that to the head gardener in particular, because they're there every day. You know, I visit the gardens maybe once or twice a month throughout the year, but they're there every day seeing what's happening. They see how trees respond. They see how plants respond to where they live, all these different things. They're caring for them, cultivating the soil. And then the trees come down and you're saying to them, look, don't worry. Nobody has planted up this landscape in 120 years and you're going to be the person that gets to do it. And so, you know, you've got to really think about, you know, positive ways to spin a fairly negative situation. Because at the end of the day, we're in the business of keeping trees up, not chopping them down. So it's a huge decision for us at any time, regardless of whether it's a storm event, an infection by a pathogen that's come in. It doesn't matter. It's a difficult thing for us to do to chop a tree down.
I guess as well because those trees are, they're such tangible historical beings in themselves.
Yeah, and they're often markers as well. I mean, sorry, I'm focusing on Ardooney just because I know those trees perhaps better than anywhere else. But, you know, and they were all Japanese larch that we had to fell there. And there's an interesting thing that happened in the felling process because we've got this big bunch of timber that we were going to use as a resource. And then what we decided to do was to mill the timber. And Gregor, the head gardener, he phoned me one day. We had many phone calls where during this project where you'd pick up the phone and go, right, Simon, I've got another thing to tell you. All right, okay, well, I'll get a cup of tea. And you sit down and this situation was, he says, look, there's all the trees have got these vertical cracks in them. I was like, all right, okay. And he says, that means the milling quality of the timber has just dropped off. It means, you know, we can't do what we set out, what we're going to do. We're going to have to rethink. And, you know, decent project management, you know, working on projects that change with lots of variable factors, you invariably meet a brick wall in which you've got to change tack and go in a different direction. And that was one of them. But the reason for me telling you that is because Gregor and I immediately just said, so I wonder how that happened. How did they get these cracks? And he went, well, it would have been a storm event, but a major one. And that leads us down the rabbit hole of debate of going, was it the storm of 87? Was it the storm of 68? And, you know, and it doesn't matter. But the point is that, you know, trees, markers put in the tree just by being in that landscape for a period of time. And, you know, and you get the same thing with beech trees. So in another garden I look after is called Greenbank in East Renfrewshire. That's a walled garden and a mansion house. And outside the walled garden is this line of beech trees, which date back to 1776. And every beech tree anywhere, I think, that where public can access it, you will find initials carved into the side of a beech tree. You know, they're almost like living little tablets, don't they? It's H loves T with a love heart through it and an arrow or whatever. And you see that everywhere. So, you know, the fact that people say maybe don't appreciate trees, they certainly interact with them, whether they like it or not, or whether they choose to remember so or not.
Those trees are up for some of them, you know, hundreds of years now, and people have made their mark on the trees as much as the trees have made their mark on the landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. And the lovely thing, you know, and this is where, to be honest with you, this is where I pinch myself with my job is I get to go about and look at these amazing trees, these amazing landscapes, and they're just historical timelines, aren't they? They're fantastic. You know, you think, well, that house and that building, we used to see in old buildings in Scotland, aren't you? You go to Glasgow, you know, St. Andrews, Ayr, any old town, and you see remnants of bygone industries, things like that. But then you look at old trees and you go, well, okay, that beech tree is 250 years old. It's beginning to show its age. It's got lots of problems. It's got structural, you know, infections, structural issues. Maybe got drainage problems. And then you think, okay, I've got to make the right decisions to get that tree to its ripe old age. And there's something really quite warming and comforting about that, to think that, you know, we're having chats, we're looking at these things, we're assessing them, we don't want to hurt them anymore, but every decision we make is actually hopefully going to help that get to its old age, which at the end of the day as a conservation organisation, that's the name of the game, isn't it?
Gosh, you talk so warmly about trees, Simon, but apart from looking at trees and making decisions to try not fell trees, tell me a bit more then about your day-to-day job with the National Trust for Scotland, because I know that it's completely varied from day to day.
It is, yeah. So I have the South and West region, and that goes all the way from Dumfries and Galloway out to Arran, up to Glasgow, out back out west again, up to Argyll, and takes in four gardens and Argyll. So it's 17 gardens in total, but I'm not on my own in this one. It would be remiss of me not to mention my good colleague, Tim Keyworth, and we're of equal footing, and we divide this big region up between us. But to answer your questions specifically, it's such a varied job. I mean, the consistency is that on a Monday and a Friday, that's my office days. And then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I'm out on the road. I spend two nights a week away from home looking at these gardens. And I think the easiest way to describe it is if every time I do a garden visit, I'll have a few things I need to talk to the head gardener about. They'll have a few things they need to talk about. And so we have this sort of intense 5 or 6, maybe 7 hours of discussing everything that's in our minds. And then after that, I write a little synopsis and send it to their boss so they know what we've talked about. And often the comment that comes back is, "What, you discussed all that today?" And we'll go through everything. I mean, we talk about trees, but we'll talk about the drainage, the historic drainage of a site. We'll talk about gardens and design landscapes overviews, which are heritage management plans and another name. We'll talk about forestry plans. We'll talk about herbaceous borders, pests and diseases, glasshouse cultivation, renovations to all these structures, innovations through, well, let's apply some biochar to a fine lawn or some rock dust or whatever it may be. And then we might focus on talking about the kit that they're using. So we're converting everything to electric kit to protect the staff and, do a little bit of climate change mitigation. So it's just all over the place, to be honest with you. And what happens at the end of each day is, So if I visit, say, a garden on a Tuesday, so today after this chat today, MT, I'm going down to Killeen, and I've got 6 things I know I need to talk about with the head gardener, and I'm only there for 3 hours, so it just won't have a break. It'll just be chat, 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 try and get some resolution to what we need to discuss, and then off we go on to the next one. So everything's changes. I think the things that are always the same are the landscapes. So no matter what our workloads are, you do this big long drive, you get to a historic, beautiful place that not many people have looked after in its lifetime, and then you get down into the details. So it's superb, actually. It's really good fun.
You talk your work with such enthusiasm. Would you then recommend that as a career choice for those who are considering a career in horticulture?
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. I mean, my background is quite an unusual one. I haven't come through a sort of conventional route. I trained at Oatridge and then the Botanics in Edinburgh and ended up working in Edinburgh Zoo for 15 years and applying my horticultural skills in a completely bizarre way when you're trying to grow plants for animals to make them happy and hopefully they'll breed and make them content. And then you think to yourself, well, how is that transferable to National Trust for Scotland? But it absolutely is, because the zoo was a Patrick Geddes designed landscape. So it's, the master planning sort of father of Edinburgh's new town, designed that landscape. And then you think, well, okay, that transfers directly over to heritage properties at National Trust for Scotland. So, but what's been amazing about working for the trust is it's taken me a couple of years to figure it out. There's no two ways about it. It's a very large, complicated organization that not only cares for gardens, it's built heritage, it's natural heritage and everything in between. So it takes a little while to get used to that. It takes a little while to get used to the driving and being a regional manager. But once you make those connections, you just realize how fortunate you are. Again, I just reiterate, you're driving to some of the most beautiful landscapes in Scotland, of which the Trust owns 38 of them. I mean, as a horticulturist, what a brilliant opportunity. You get to drive up to Wester Ross, which is just the journey alone to Wester Ross is beautiful. Then you get there and you go to Inverewe and you learn about Osgood Mackenzie and how that landscape was developed and created with this enormous walled garden that's right by the coast. And you'll pop over to Crathis in the northeast, or Drum or Fivey or Leith Hall, where it'd been such an exposed garden the way up and top there. And and then you're coming back down the country and you get to Kelly Castle and it's all organic and beautiful produce. It's paradise for a horticulturist. So highly recommend it to anybody. I mean, we have our we did have an apprenticeship program. We've got trainees that come out of Thrieve Garden and Dumfries and Galloway, and that's the trust training gardeners to sort of feed back into our own gardens. And yeah, an amazing career. Absolutely. I just wish I'd started it just a wee bit earlier, just to get that extra sort of 7 or 8 years worth of experience. So, there's so much to learn, so much to do. It's genuine privilege, actually.
very inspirational, obviously, Simon, for those who are considering a career in horticulture, not just straight from school, but for career changers, to think that there are all these opportunities in Scotland now that you can get involved in. The field is massive now, and to be able to be part of looking after Scotland's heritage, to protect it for future generations, is just an amazing opportunity.
It is, yeah, and it's interesting you say career changers. Horticulture's always had career changers. I think that's the case. But I think since COVID, we've noticed a few more. The intake at Thrive, you know, we're getting 29-30 applicants for the five positions every year. And more we're noticing that it's much more of the career changer. So a little bit more mature, you know, sort of late 30s, early 40s. They've had a career perhaps in business or, you know, teaching, whatever it may be, and they've decided that they want to get into horticulture. It's an interesting thing because I think, you know, there are those that get into horticulture very early in their lives, and they're often influenced by a parent, a grandparent, that sort of thing, and that's their inspiration. And then the career changers, quite often you'll find in conversation with them, they go, well, I just started gardening because of this reason in my life. And then they start doing it and they realize that actually all of a sudden they feel a bit happier. And then they go, oh, you know, there's something in this plant, Malark, you know, I might give this a go. And then before you know it, they're looking to change career. And in other words, they found plants and plants have found them. And I think that's the thing about horticulture. You know, no matter what your mood is, no matter how you're feeling, I challenge anyone to go for work in their own wee garden or go for a walk in the woods where you're immersed by vegetation. Your mood will change. You'll be in a better position mentally than what you were when you started out in that wee journey. And I think that goes for everybody. The frustrating thing, though, and, you know, I'm not going to eulogize it to death here, but the frustrating thing, I think, is when you've done your training in horticulture and you've spent a bit of time in a garden, there's a little shift that happens mentally. And I kind of call it the sort of 101 issue. And it's the fact that, you know, when you work in a garden, there's always 101 things to do. And therefore, sometimes it feels like you never finish anything. And you don't. Because of the nature of our work, it's a seasonal thing. So you're always, as soon as you finish one thing, you're moving on to another thing. And so it goes and so forth. And that can actually create a little bit of stress for people from time to time. But they need to remember that, you know, that you can't possibly get everything you want to get done in a garden. It's just impossible. If you did, then you'd probably just have AstroTurf and some concrete, you know, and you're out with a brush. but yeah.
You get to work in something, working alongside nature. We're not trying to control it. So it's always going to evolve of its own volition as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah. And it does fit. It's interesting you say the control as well, because, you know, I often think, you know, gardeners are a little bit of control freaks, maybe. You know, they like to manipulate their environment just a little bit, you know. I don't know. I think my wife would probably say, yes, he definitely is, you know. because that's your skill, isn't it? That's the craft. You know, you're trying to grow plants sometimes in situations where they've got no business being there. You know, in my front garden at home, I live in the East Coast, and it's a little postage stamp piece of garden where no one's allowed on it. And that's just my wee bit. And try and grow woodland plants, alpine plants, fruit, vegetables, you know, you name it. I try and cram it and everything I can into a tiny wee space. And the trick of the trade for me is to just try and control what's going on in the soil and the little environment to get those plants to grow. So it does fit a lot of personality types, shall we say, if I'd be diplomatic.
So tell us a wee bit more then about what your own garden's like.
In the back, I'm looking at it just now, actually. So it's not that big. I live in a semi-detached house in the village of Kinghorn. I've got a wee garden at the back, a little bit of lawn. I've got some raised beds. But what I do like to do in the back is try things that are not quite hardy. So just now I've got some climbers on the go, one called Solanum heterophylla, which has just been battered by the wind the last few days. Got another unusual little clematis from the Balearic Islands. Got Lanicera that most folk haven't heard of, that seems to be doing okay. And that's just my little experimentation. So I always do little experiments just to see what can be handled. And that's out the back. So everybody in the family's got access to that. So there's a bit of lawn. And I don't mind that getting a wee bit trashed. The cats love digging in it, which is a bit of a nuisance, to be honest. But out the front, that's my little plaything. So I've managed to squeeze in about 130 species of plants into a tiny wee area. But in that, I think the thing that I like experimenting on the most is actually it's a type of cypress tree called Metasequoia, Glyptus troboides, which comes from China. So it's a Chinese deciduous conifer, closely related to the, sorry, I said cypress, it's a redwood, and closely related to swamp cypress in eastern USA and the redwoods of western USA. And what I like to do with that is chop it and stress it and see if I can get it into different shapes. And the reason why I do that is because 12 years ago when I planted it, I thought, oh, I'd love this Metsequoia in my garden. I'll just bang that in the ground. And within about 4 years, it reached the height of the house, and all of a sudden I was having to chop it down, and it was way too big. So what I do now is I've monolithed it into this cylinder shape at the moment. It sounds a bit mad, but that's what I've done. And that's just to see, because the option's empty, where I was going to have to chop it out. So if I'm going to have to chop it out, I might as well just play with it a little bit. So it's now in a sort of rough cylinder shape, and I pruned it into that shape so that I can see how it buds internally. So that's just to see if it bud breaks from the main stem. And you think, well, what's that got to do with the trust? Well, hedging is quite an important thing in the trust. We've got lots of formal gardens. We've got lots of areas that we need to segregate off from others. And species and choice of hedges is something we often talk about in the background. Some of the reasons for that is we need to change because of different infections and pathogens that come in, like box suffers from box blight. It's a real problem in the Northeast. So I might as well experiment with something that's a bit unusual. So that's what I do in the front there. It's all experimentation. And I suppose if I was to tell you some of the plants, you know, there's everything from little bits of alpines and saxifrages. There's some lovely herbaceous plants like phlomis. I've got some herbs on the go. I've got sort of rose that's poor little straggly thing struggling to get life and nutrients in amongst, you know, some shrubs like cerberia and various bits and bobs like that. So all sorts of things.
So you said you've got 130 different species crammed in there.
Yeah.
But if I had to pin you down then, and you could only have three plants in your garden, and I ask every guest on the podcast this, so if you could only have three plants in your garden,
yeah,
what would they be and why?
Okay, that's a good question. So I think the first thing I'll go for is an apple tree. And I would probably choose the variety Discovery, mainly because it's absolutely delicious. It's such a sweet, beautiful apple. Almost has hints of pear in there as well, and it's a little bit of pink flesh. So I love showing that to the kids because it looks a bit odd. But the reason, another reason for the apple tree is it's beautiful. So you get apple blossom, so it's a flowering tree. You get autumn colour. In terms of horticulture, and you know, I'll go back to that sort of control element. You know, there's nothing more controlling than what you need to do to an apple tree to get it to flower and to produce good fruit for you. So I think for those reasons, you know, it's good seasonal interest. It's lovely to look at. It's good to care for and cultivate, and it gives you something to eat. Fantastic. So that would be the first one.
George Anderson picked an apple tree as his first choice as well.
Oh, did he? Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. But I mean, it also symbolises, from a horticultural point of view, it symbolises hundreds of years worth of craft. You know, the industries in the UK, you know, you think, and even in Gloucestershire, they used to have over 400 varieties of pear in one area of England, you know, and where have all these things gone? And the same for the ancient forests of orchards of Scotland as well. You know, they do exist, and the trust cares for a lot of these varieties, actually, of apple. And I think it's a crying shame that these have disappeared from our plates, you know, and been able to access them and buy them. So And I think apple trees, when you think of what has to be done in order to get them to grow, you know, there's a lot of knowledge goes into that. There's hundreds of years of craft handed down through generations to be able to get it to grow properly. So, you know, we may manipulate it to get it to do what we want, but it's the perfect symbol of horticulture, I think.
Yeah, and we carried a nice piece of copy in the last issue of Scotland Grows magazine on Scotland's apple heritage and some of the varieties that are growing. So that was really informative.
Was that Colin? Was it, yeah. Colin Wren? That's my colleague in the East. So yeah, he's our resident apple expert, a top guy, yes. Really good knowledge there. So the other thing I choose, so I was just going to say, I'm a big lover of bamboo. I have three nice big bamboos in my back garden. This goes back to my time at the zoo where I was the chap that helped bring the pandas and sourced all their food for them and designed their enclosure. So it's kind of stuck with me because I traveled all over Europe looking for different bamboos. But I think one of the main reasons for including that is not just because of that. It's because it's such a versatile plant. I mean, it doesn't flower. Well, it does flower, but once it flowers, it dies. But it's brilliant for your garden. You've always got a source of canes. You've got a source of staking material all the time. And you can get as much as you want off of it, and it just keeps growing back. You don't have to feed it. You've got to be careful how the roots spread clearly. So you've got to choose your species wisely so that you don't have a spreading root system, more of a clumping. My cats love it. They love nestling in it and sleeping in it. And on a hot summer's day, mice like building wee nests in it. And the good thing about bamboos is they feed themselves. So the leaves that get blown off in the wind, that's all they need. You never need to feed them. They sort themselves out. They tend to be quite drought tolerant as well as good in waterlogged conditions. So, and they nod in the wind, and birds like using them for nesting material and all sorts of bits and bobs. So yeah, I'm a big fan of bamboo. And I suppose the third one, MT, would be potatoes, actually. And I suppose I'm focusing on something to eat. They're a lovely plant to look at. But again, it gives us something to eat, and it's so simple to produce a crop of potatoes. I mean, okay, they get blight, and when you look at the books, it's a bit scary at times because you look at the any potato books, and the amount of pests and diseases they get is just phenomenal. But if you get a few things right, you know, more often than not, you'll get a good crop, and you'll get cropping all through the season. So you'll have your first earlies, your second earlies, your main crop kicks in. So you can have potatoes from May all the way through to December and January if you can store them properly. So I just think that's a fantastic thing to have. King Edward's perhaps quite a favourite of mine as a main crop. It's quite a traditional one, but the reason why I like it is because my youngest daughter loves roast tatties, so and it's a really fluffy potato, so that's why I choose that one.
Very impressed with that choice, Simon, because I'm a massive potato grower as well and lover, and they're such a versatile crop.
Well, they are, aren't they? And there's a huge variety in Scotland. Scotland actually has quite a wealth and tradition of growing potatoes. There's an amazing chap in Kirkcaldy, just a couple of miles away from me, called John, who's the tatty man, and he's worked with tatties his whole life. His dad did, his grandfather did, and his knowledge of potatoes is just phenomenal. And I met him at Gardening Scotland one time. You remember they used to have those big displays of potatoes, and I met him at the stall there. And you just meet people that what's the expression? They know a lot about a little, if that makes sense, and they're just so focused on their one particular area, and he just knows everything about potatoes. So just, you meet someone like that, you have you think is going to be a 2-minute conversation. It turns into half an hour of just in-depth potato chat. Yeah. And then before you know it, you love potatoes.
So if you only had 3 plants in your garden, you would be eating potatoes and eating apples, as well as having some nice structural interest from your apple tree and from your bamboo. So that would be a garden you could live in.
Yeah, it's not bad. I mean, it's kind of what it's like just now, so that's fine. it's not quite desert island discs, is it? But it's the horticultural equivalent.
absolutely. Well, Simon, if I could ask you then a final question. Given all of your experience in what you've done in your career, what would be the best piece of gardening advice that you could give to new gardeners or those who, they've never gardened before, but they just want to get out and to start gardening?
I think the main thing is don't be afraid, because it can actually be quite daunting. You think, well, what do I need to do here? There's so many books, there's so much literature out there to start, but don't be afraid. Have a go, and try and get the system where you understand how to germinate a seed. So get it, and fruit and vegetables are perhaps a good place to start, because if you can have the hook of taking, for example, sow some carrot seeds and then produce a crop, I think that's a hugely satisfying feeling to get something from seed to plate, and knowing that your hands have helped that plant get to that journey. You're going to make mistakes. That is just absolutely part of it. Every year I try things, every year things fail, but I just keep trying, and you've just got to keep doing that. So never be afraid, and just have a go. And actually, look about your local area. you'll easily spot somebody that's a keen gardener just by what you see in their own garden, and strike up a conversation. It's a good way to meet people. You'll often get really good tips from local people, because what can happen in one part of the country and then another in terms of growing situation can be vastly different. And that goes the same for books. You know, you read a book and it'll tell you the parameters at which you can grow that plant, and that sometimes doesn't fit your actual geographical location. So have a go and try and meet some local people, and they'll give you some good advice.
Yeah, those are great tips. And I assume you would also recommend visiting an NTS garden.
Do you have
any favourites? I know that's like asking you to choose your favourite child.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I think the good thing about the Trust Gardens is there's something for everybody all through Scotland, and that's what's cracking about it. But if I was to pick one to go and visit, I think it would be the garden I first went to in the Trust and where my office was, which is Greenbank Garden in East Renfrewshire. I think it's a 2.5 acre walled garden. It's intense, the amount of horticulture that exists within there. It's got history, it's got tradition, and it's got something for everyone, because it's what's called a demonstration garden, and it's divided up into little rooms. And each of those little rooms has something to offer for somebody. And it grows everything from produce to fine lawns to alpines to trees, shrubs, you name it, it grows it in a small space. So that would be one I would recommend.
And Greenbank Garden is a very near me, Simon. So next time you're actually at Greenbank, let me know and we'll come and have a cup of tea and you can do your tour of Greenbank. But yeah, as you say, it is a fabulous garden.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And the interesting thing, you know, when you look at the history of the Trust, is that garden was, and that estate was created to stop encroaching development in the 1700s. You know, and you look at it now and it's actually hemmed in by urban sort of spread, if you like. And so it's just a little green oasis in the edge of the city. So it's well worth a visit.
Yeah, it's a haven. It's really, really lovely. Well, that was so great to talk to you, Simon. And thank you so much for giving up some of your day. I know you're extremely busy maintaining, on all of our behalf, all of these gardens and managed landscapes across Scotland. So thank you so very much for your time today.
You're most welcome. It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Scotland Grows Show. Don't forget to follow us on social media by searching for Scotland Grows across Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. And sign up for our mailing list so you never miss an episode of the Scotland Grows Show. And if you are not yet subscribed to receive Scotland Grows magazine, 6 times a year, straight to your inbox, literally packed with Scottish gardening goodness, then be sure to do so as soon as possible, and you'll even get access to all the back issues. Details can be found on our website at scotlandgrowsmagazine.com, across our social media feeds, and in the show notes for each episode. The information on the National Trust for Scotland's Root subscription is also in the show notes, and they would appreciate your support to help National Trust for Scotland's gardens and designed landscapes thrive. I look forward to you joining me on the next episode of the Scotland Grows Show as we celebrate Scottish gardening.